Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. I'd like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Brian Vinnick. Dr. Vinnick received his medical degree from a very small community college, University of Michigan. He completed his residency at Vanderbilt Hospital and completed his fellowship in endocrinology at the University of North Carolina, a division of endocrinology. He's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine and subspecialty endocrinology and metabolism. He's currently a physician locally and in the practice of endocrinology and metabolism at East Coast Medical Associates. He's also currently clinical associate assistant professor of medicine and biomedical science at Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine at FAU. He has several publications that presented multiple papers. This morning, Dr. Vinnick's topic is hypercalcemia. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Vinnick.
All right. Thanks for that introduction, which I think is way lengthier than I actually deserve. Thanks, everyone, for coming out here. As you guys know, I tend to not wear ties very often, and last year I did a talk on diabetes and popped on a tie, so I picked out my best one for this morning, and once a year probably I'll put on a tie. Can you hear me? Okay. Gary? Okay. I've had a bit of a bug, so my voice is not at its usual amplitude. Is that better? Yeah, I'll try to lean in a little. I think this was made for someone a little taller than me, too. So we're going to be talking about hypercalcemia. Is there anyone here who's had a patient with hypercalcemia? Show of hands. Okay, everyone's eating. Otherwise, I'm sure your hands would be up. So it's very, very common. And in the outpatient setting, about 85% of it is hyperparathyroidism, primary hyperparathyroidism. But it's not all parathyroid. And so often people refer patients to us, they'll have hypercalcemia with a high parathyroid, and they'll assume that we're going to operate on that patient, and we don't. So there are other causes of hypercalcemia with a high parathyroid and other causes of hypercalcemia with a low parathyroid. And so we'll investigate a little about the causes and metabolism of hypercalcemia, the symptoms, the comorbidities, when to operate, when to treat medically, and how you should follow someone with hypercalcemia if you're not going to do either of the above. If you have any questions during the talk, go ahead and just put up your hand or yell out at me. I'm quite happy to stop at any point and talk about whatever you guys have issues with. If you have specific patient questions about a tricky patient, maybe better to come up afterwards and talk to me or give me a ring at the office, because I know all of you guys have a busy schedule and have to get back to patient care. So our objectives are to look at calcium metabolism. And when I first started my fellowship in 1996, Dr. David Anches was working on calcium metabolism. And I was interested in diabetes, obesity, dyslipidemia. And I said, what is calcium metabolism? And what is bone metabolism? Because I've actually never heard of it. And so we've come a long way, and medical knowledge doubles every 10 years, and I've been out 20 years, so we have maybe four times the medical knowledge now that we had when I was in fellowship. And so we know a lot more about calcium metabolism, and the important thing is we know how to modulate calcium metabolism and osteoporosis to improve patient outcomes. So we'll look at the signs, symptoms, and comorbidities, the differential diagnosis, and the evaluation process, and that gets very important in terms of the fourth one, treatment, and we'll talk generally and then more specifically about modalities of treatment. So calcium and phosphorus make up bone. Calcium total body, about a kilo. When your patient comes in and they're kind of heavy, and I see a lot of referrals for people who are overweight and there's an endocrine problem and they say they're big boned, well, there's about a kilogram of calcium in there, and you know, about 0.6 over here. So you know, maybe a couple of kilos of bone. The rest of it, unfortunately, is not being heavy boned. Bone, 99% of the total calcium is stored there. You also have some in your teeth. And then there's plasma protein binding. So about 48% of the calcium is ionized. And as you know, with hormones, it's the free hormones that are active. With calcium, it's the ionized calcium that is the functional calcium in your body. And that's going to lead to either feeling good or not feeling so good. Dietary intake, about a gram to 1,500 milligrams a day, and that's elemental calcium. So when you take a Tums calcium carbonate, about 40% of it is elemental. If you take calcium citrate, about 21% of that is elemental. So when you're recommending calcium intake in terms of elemental, you have to think about the form that someone's ingesting it, or if they come in with hypercalcemia and you ask them what they're taking, you need to calculate how much is elemental. So here's the calcium and phosphorus flux. We'll just look at the calcium up top. There it's coming in your diet, a gram to 1.5 a day. It gets ingested, and with vitamin D, it gets absorbed, and about 30% of that. And then there's this whole interplay with bone matrix and plasma protein binding. Some of it comes out in the urine, not that much, and the rest of it goes out in the stool. So in terms of the plasma protein binding, each gram per deciliter of albumin binds 0.8 milligrams per deciliter of calcium. So you have a correction formula that you guys are all familiar with. So if you have a low albumin, you subtract the albumin count from 4, multiply by the factor of 0.8, and then add that to the measured calcium, and you'll get your actual serum calcium. So a lot of our patients are malnourished, and their albumin's low. They have a calcium that is low. Here's an example, and then it may correct to normal. And the opposite will happen if you have a high albumin. You'll subtract that from the measured calcium, and you'll get a lower than the measured calcium. Calcium and pH. Calcium is bound to the carboxyl groups on albumin, so it's highly pH-dependent. So if you have an acidosis, you have decreased binding, and you release more ionized calcium into the circulation. The opposite happens with alkalosis. So it'll increase binding to serum proteins and albumin, and you lower your ionized calcium. So if you have someone who's sick with a borderline calcium, and they may be intubated, and you hyperventilate them for whatever reason, say they have increased intracerebral pressure, that'll drop your ionized calcium, and you can have paresthesias. So it's important to correct the calcium before you hyperventilate them so that they don't have signs and symptoms of hypo. So I mentioned the gut absorption, and that's modulated by vitamin D. 125-dihydroxy vitamin D is its full name, and that causes calcium and phosphorus absorption in the intestine. So it increases the absorption of magnesium as well. In the kidney, it increases distal tubule reabsorption of calcium. So now you have calcium going in through the gut, and you have it going out through the urine, and vitamin D will make you absorb it here and make you reabsorb it there. So there are two mechanisms. On bone, it increases osteoid mineralization, increased bone resorption, and decreases osteoblast activity. And then in the parathyroid, it'll suppress parathyroid hormone gene transcription and therefore release and decreases parathyroid cell proliferation. So there are multiple mechanisms by which vitamin D has action on calcium, and generally to raise calcium. Then there's this feedback loop, so if your calcium's too high and your vitamin D is too high, it'll suppress PTH. So like all of the endocrine systems, there's this nice feedback loop. It's a busy slide, but basically vitamin D is activated from cholesterol in the skin. Everyone over here is vitamin D deficient despite living in Florida. We're told not to go out in the sun because of skin cancer and so on. So a lot of my patients, most of them, need vitamin D supplementation. The liver does the 25-hydroxylation, and then the kidney does the 1-hydroxylation, and that's the active step. And that leads to the function and actions of 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D. So problems with the liver or problems with the kidney can lead to low vitamin D, and other issues can lead to high vitamin D. So here's the curve of serum parathyroid hormone and blood ionized calcium, and it's kept in this very narrow range by parathyroid hormone. And we'll talk a lot about parathyroid today. Parathyroid and parathyroid hormone related protein are two compounds that modulate calcium action. It's the same receptor for both, and actually there are three receptors that we know of. And it's the PTH receptor 1, which is the major one that governs the action of parathyroid hormone. 2 and 3 are of lesser importance. So this is found in osteoblasts and in the kidney. There are high concentration in the growth plate chondrocytes. And the PTH-related protein actually does have physiologic roles although it is pathologic in cancer syndromes, and there's probably paracrine and autocrine actions. So it is important in regular homeostasis of calcium, various organs that can be pathologic, and we'll talk more about that. The PTH2 receptor is found in other places. There may be a role in regulation of blood flow, such as in the placenta. So what does parathyroid do? Well, essentially, its end effect is to stimulate this RANK ligand, receptor-activated ligand, and that'll stimulate the osteoclast to go in and work on bone and dig calcium out of bone from type 1 collagen. And then there's some paracrine actions with the osteoblasts so that there'll be new bone deposited, and that gives you your bone turnover. So problems with either of these, the osteoblasts or osteoclasts, can lead to or hypocalcemia and or bone dysmorphogenesis. So the RANK ligand is expressed by osteoblasts in response to parathyroid hormone, PTHRP, and 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, as well as a variety of cytokines that may be normal or abnormal, such as in humoral hypercalcemia of malignancy, coming from various tumor cells. So here's your little Pac-Man. This is your osteoclast, and this is the little darling of bone. It goes along there and it chumps up the bone, releases calcium, releases phosphate. Too much action over here is going to cause osteoporosis and hypercalcemia. And this is the RANK ligand, so you have this RANK receptor. The ligand comes along, that'll stimulate the osteoclast, and off it goes doing its work. So because it's an endocrine organ, bone is an endocrine organ, there's going to be checks and balances. So what are the checks and balances? You get this osteoprotegerin coming from the osteoblast, and that'll have this paracrine action to actually inhibit RANK ligand on the osteoclast. So now we have this nice little setup where we have parathyroid stimulating RANK, and the osteoclast does its thing. The osteoblast has this paracrine feedback so that it says, don't chomp up too much bone. I've got to deposit bone before you go any further. There's one other factor here, and that's this LGR4. That'll also mop up any RANK ligand that's floating around, and that'll prevent it binding to the receptor on the osteoclast. So these two over here will actually prevent the osteoclast action, and the RANK ligand stimulated by parathyroid and PTHRP will activate the osteoclast. So now we're painting a picture of parathyroid hormone, vitamin D, calcium, phosphorus, the pH, the protein binding, dietary intake, and urinary and fecal excretion of calcium, and the system of calcium metabolism on the bone, again, where 99% of your calcium is stored. So it becomes like a seesaw. I'm sure everyone's been on a seesaw, and here we go up and down. If you have more RANK ligand activity from parathyroid hormone, you'll have more osteoclast activity, and if you have OPG in abundance, it'll mop up the RANK ligand, and the osteoclast will not be stimulated. So that's our system of checks and balances. So looking at bone markers, we can see what the osteoclast is doing. We can look at osteocalcin, which is a marker for osteoblast activity. Other things you can look at are bone-specific alkaline phosphatase. So this will be elevated in active bone loss. When we look at the urine and the serum telopeptide or pyrrolynx, we're looking at the collagen breakdown products. So it's also a marker for osteoclast activity, and it's going to be elevated in bone loss, and it'll look at collagen loss from bone turnover. So when we look at parathyroid action on the osteoclast and we say, is it really parathyroid that's raising the calcium, we can look at these markers, and if they're not elevated, then it's probably not the osteoclast and parathyroid that's leading to the hypercalcemia and or bone loss, and you have to look elsewhere. So what makes parathyroid hormone get released? We know that vitamin D inhibits the gene transcription, but when it comes down to the actual release, what is it? It's this calcium-sensing receptor, and it's one of these seven transmembrane-spanning G proteins that's responsible for a lot of other functions, such as thyroid hormone. And this over here will sense the ambient calcium level. Hope that wasn't me.
Okay, good.
Is that Bethesda coming in? And this will sense the ambient calcium levels, and if the calcium level is high, then it'll shut off parathyroid, and if the calcium level is low, then it'll make more parathyroid hormone. This is also found in the kidney, in the renal tubule, because the kidneys have to know what to do with calcium. So if there's too much calcium in the body, then the kidney's going to secrete more calcium, and if there's not enough calcium, then the kidney's going to reabsorb more calcium. So this calcium-sensing receptor works both at the parathyroid hormone secretion level and at the kidney level. So the parathyroid sheath cells are what secrete PTH in response to the ambient calcium levels, and in the kidney determining the amount of calcium in the urine. And the thyroid C cells also have a receptor, and they make calcitonin, and the actual physiologic role of calcitonin is still somewhat unclear, but we know that calcium can lower calcium when you have hypercalcemia, and that's something that we can use therapeutically. So what are the manifestations? Well, at our little school up in Michigan, this is what I was taught, bone stones and abdominal groans. So people will have bone pain. They'll have potentially kidney stones and abdominal groans. So we'll talk about why that may be. You have the neuropsychiatric symptoms up top here, fatigue, lethargy, poor memory, poor concentration, and eventually stupor and coma. And I've seen people with calciums in the 13s and 14s, and the highest I've seen is 18, which is almost not compatible with life. And interestingly, it's a lady who has hypoparathyroidism from resection of thyroid cancer, and she moved from New York to Florida and was found to have a calcium of 18, and she was in a coma. And she hypothesized that it was the light that she was getting from sunlight in Florida that activated her vitamin D, and she was probably correct. So we have on a lot less calcium and vitamin D right now than she needed up north. Personality change. Then you get the GI effects such as the nausea, anorexia, constipation, peptic ulcer disease, pancreatitis, the renal disease, polyuria from the increased calcium load and excretion, kidney stones, nephrocalcinosis, hypertension, looking at the cardiac, and hypertension could be in the renal or the cardiac, bradycardia, short QT interval, atrioventricular block. You can get calcification of the conduction system causing that. And then in terms of bone and the skeletal system, you get bone pain, pathologic fractures. You can also get what's not on the slide, these brown tumors that are not cancers, but I think of it sort of as like Padgett's. You get these whorls in the bone of the osteoclasts and the osteoblasts not really working in coordination with each other, and you can see those on x-rays. Muscle weakness and arthralgia. So severe hypercalcemia leads to severe symptomatology and really decreases quality of life, and we have to treat people accordingly, both acutely and then long term. So the gastrointestinal manifestations, why do you get them? Well, hypercalcemia depresses the autonomic nervous system. You get smooth muscle hypotonicity and then increased gastric residual volume. So this is sort of like my patients with diabetic autonomic neuropathy with gastroparesis, where they have early postprandial satiety, the belly gets full really quickly and they can't eat anymore. If they do, they get sick and they throw up. And also the constipation because of the decreased gastric motility, probably for the same reasons. Looking at the kidneys, nephrocalcinosis and nephrolithiasis. So here you have bilateral renal pelvis calculi. And then you also get osteoporosis, and it's hard to show a slide of osteoporosis, but you get decreased cortical and especially trabecular bone, which is where the osteoclast works. So looking at the mechanisms of hypercalcemia, you have increased bone resorption, you have increased intestinal absorption, and decreased renal excretion for the mechanisms that we've described. So primary hyperparathyroidism, again, if someone walks into the office as an outpatient with hypercalcemia, 85 to 90% of them are going to have primary hyperparathyroidism, and 85% of that will be one or two glands. Occasionally, you'll have hyperplasia, double adenomas and so on. So what you have is an inappropriately elevated parathyroid for a given calcium. And it's really important to understand that definition. So if a normal calcium is, say, 9.5, and a normal parathyroid is 10 to 65, which is a huge range, someone comes in with a calcium of 12 and a normal parathyroid of 30, they have hyperparathyroidism by definition because the parathyroid level should be suppressed. So that is someone with hyperparathyroidism. And then you have to figure out if it's primary, secondary, and so on. So don't let a normal parathyroid level or a parathyroid in the normal range let you think that it's not hyperparathyroidism. And then you need to do the rest of your workup. So again, usually a single adenoma about 85% of the time. DNA deletions. The patient always wants to know, why did I get this? And you tell them, well, it's something genetic and maybe familial. We'll see. You may have an increased cell mass of the chief cells. It may be an altered set point, and the set point is governed by that calcium sensing receptor that we talked about. Hyperplasia you can have about 10% of the time, and then dual adenomas. So we've had a few people with dual adenomas. For instance, my mother had parathyroid surgery, and they did a left upper. They did an intraoperative parathyroid assay, which is a rapid assay, and her parathyroid level didn't come down 50%, and it didn't normalize. And the surgeon said, I'm going to look further, and sure enough, there was a smaller right lower pole adenoma. So, you know, the surgeon needs to be aware of what they're looking at. Sometimes another smaller second adenoma won't show on an ultrasound or a preoperative nucleus scan, sestamibi scan. Rarely parathyroid carcinoma. Anyone in here seen someone with parathyroid carcinoma? It's pretty unlikely, because in 20 years I haven't. And I've seen some really nasty looking, I think Dr. Witteroff can attest to that, we've seen some really big, nasty looking, fibrous, huge parathyroid glands that you're sure is going to be cancerous, and the pathologist says no. But it does exist about 1% of the time, and of all the patients that I've seen, I'm still at a zero, so, which is probably a good thing. So hyperparathyroidism and the multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, MEN type 1, about 2 in 100,000 prevalence, tumors in parathyroid, pituitary, and pancreatic islet cells, so those are your three Ps, parathyroid, pituitary, and pancreas. It has nearly 100% penetrance, so if someone's got the gene, they're going to have hyperparathyroidism. It accounts for about 2% of hyperparathyroid cases, and you can also see it released by various other things, such as gastrinomas and so on. We talk about the APUD, APUD, cells, enterochromaffin-like tumors, carcinoids, which is one of my father's specialties. And so sometimes you have to look for extra parathyroid or extra neck secretion of parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid presents earlier if associated with MEN. So if you have a young person, think about the family history very carefully and think about looking for genetic causes. More likely to have multiple gland involvement, and that's important for treatment in terms of surgery, and a high recurrence following successful surgery. So if a young person has what appears to be a single gland and they have surgery, it may come back, so they should be monitored. MEN type 2, and this is the classical nomenclature of 2A and 2B. It's also associated with familial medullary thyroid cancer. About 75% are 2A, and it's only the 2A that manifests the hyperparathyroidism. So if you get someone with type 2 and they've got funny bumps on their tongue and their lips and they're a 2B, they probably won't have hyperparathyroidism. But don't forget that you can have concomitant primary hyperparathyroidism with any other syndrome, even MEN type 2B. The important thing about this is that these people can have pheos. And so if you have someone who's got MEN2 and you send them for surgery and they have a pheo, they could die on the table. So make sure that you evaluate them for pheochromocytoma prior to surgery. And that's usually multiglandular 2, 3, or 4. And so often we'll do a 3.5 gland resection where you take out four glands and you reimplant another one either in the neck or in the forearm, where you can find it by radiologic imaging fairly easily if they develop hyperparathyroidism in the future. Looking at FHH, so this one's the big pretender. This is the one where you have high calcium, high parathyroid, but you typically don't have kidney stones and it's usually asymptomatic. The hallmark about this is that it's got 100% penetrance. So if you have this, and it's usually familial, the patient will have a lifetime history of hypercalcemia. So if I have someone who 10 years ago had completely normal calciums, and then they come in with hypercalcemia, and I think it's this, it's not, because their calciums will have been high forever, because they were born with this. And this is an inactivating mutation of the calcium-sensing receptor. So the CSR looks at the ambient calcium level, and instead of parathyroid level being suppressed, it goes up a little. Usually the parathyroid is not above 100, so that's a caveat. And I have a patient right now with a parathyroid levels in the 120s, and I think it's this, but I'm not quite sure, because that's an outlier. So the hallmark is hypocalciuria. This is how you diagnose this. You have a high parathyroid, but still usually less than 100, a calcium that's about 10.5 to 10.9, usually not over 11, but occasionally if they're dehydrated, and a low urine calcium. So the urine calcium to creatinine clearance will be less than 0.01. So you do that calculation, that'll tell you where you are. It's kind of like looking at a fractional excretion of sodium when you're looking at volume and renal failure. So there will be a family history, and it's autosomal dominant, so you need it from only one parent, and 100% penetrant. So this is the great pretender. Do not operate on these people. That's not the correct diagnosis if you go to surgery. So then we talk about malignancy. And so again, in the outpatient setting, 90% of these people with hypercalcemia have hyperparathyroidism, and in the hospital, you have more with malignancy or other causes. So PTH-related protein is one of the modulators. You have osteolytic metastases, cytokines, and other humoral factors that I mentioned early on. 1-alpha hydroxylase production, which often comes from lymphomas. Poor prognosis if you have hypercalcemia of malignancy, often is less than a 6-month survival. Time here. So in terms of malignant diseases, looking at percent of total cases, the lung and the breast are most common, almost 25% on both of those, and then it lessens depending on what your other diagnosis is. And you can see in terms of lymphoma, it's actually fairly low overall. And here you see thyroid down here. It's only about 2%. So if you want to go look for where the gold is, when someone's got hypercalcemia and malignancy, look at lung and breast. If you're looking at hematologic malignancies, adult T-cell lymphoma and leukemia, sometimes associated with HTLV-1, 50 to 90%. So if it is a hematologic malignancy, that's where the money is. And then, of course, myeloma is fairly high up there, malignant lymphoma, and then the others are lower down. So what mediates the hypercalcemia of malignancy? Some of these cytokines, but of course PTHRP is one of the primary ones, and we have an assay for that. You can just order PTHRP, and a few days later you'll get a result. Similar structure to parathyroid, 8 of the first 13 amino acids are identical, similar biologic effects. It is somewhat more complicated than the parathyroid hormone gene, and physiologically, it has these paracrine and autocrine actions, often related to blood flow, as I mentioned, such as in the placenta. Different isoforms from alternative splicing, and it has equivalent binding affinity for the PTH receptors, so it can work just like parathyroid hormone. The only difference is you get high calcium, you get decreased phosphorus like parathyroid, but you don't get an elevated 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D level. So if you're looking at a case and you see a high 1,25-D level, it's probably not PTHRP that is mediating that, so think about something else. So when you have PTHRP, these are the usual suspects, as they say, squamous cell, renal, breast cancer, and then others. So here's the structure in terms of amino acids. You get PTHRP. You can see overall it's longer, but there's three different splicing variants. And here's parathyroid. 1 through 34 with both of these molecules right here is where you have PTH bioactivity binding to the PTH1, which is the main receptor in bone, as we discussed. So how do we know that you actually need PTHRP for survival? When they took mice and they did a knockout of the gene, it was lethal. So we need PTHRP to survive. At least mice do. We assume that humans do. So it does have physiologic function. So various neoplastic conditions, PTHRP levels. Well, here is normal, and they're all low. Humoral hypercalcemia of malignancy, they're all normal to high. When you look at solid tumors with bone mets, normal to high, and you know some of it's mediated by other factors, as we discussed. In breast cancer, normal to very, very high. And in primary hyperparathyroidism, the PTHRP is normal, as you would expect. So then we look at medications. So the first thing we do when someone comes in is we say, hello, how are you doing? And then you get a history. And history is number 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the list, you know, for making any diagnosis. You look at the history, family history, and medications. So thiazides, all you guys are familiar with thiazides, decreasing calcium in the urine. Sometimes we do it therapeutically to prevent kidney stones. But if someone's on a thiazide, they may have hypercalcemia. Lithium, vitamin D excess. As I mentioned, everyone's in vitamin D now. Some people take too much vitamin D. The milk alkali syndrome, and I'll go over some of these in more detail in a second. Aminophilin, cyclic AMP is one of the mediators of aminophilin and also on calcium metabolism, so that could be why. Tamoxifen possibly antagonizing the effect of estrogen. And a few others. Thyroid hormone we'll talk about in a second. So lithium interferes with the calcium sensing receptor so that the set point is changed, mild persistent hypercalcemia, and it can persist for a long time. So once you stop the lithium, it'll still go on for a few months after stopping the treatment because this set point needs to be reset. Occasionally you'll get hyperplasia, so the parathyroid cells are constitutively activated because of the change in set point, and it'll take a long, long time for this hyperplasia to resolve, if it ever does. So this is a change in the set point. It basically moves this curve to the right. So for any given level of parathyroid, you're going to have a higher serum calcium. So say I take a PTH of 40, come across here, get the calcium, you're going to have a higher ionized calcium for any given parathyroid level. So the treatment there is simple. If you can, stop the lithium, speak to the psychiatrist, and you know, see if there's an alternative. Thiazides, enhancing renal reabsorption and distal renal tubule. You also may be volume depleted because of the diuretic, and those two things together will cause hypercalcemia. So again, stop the drug if you have hypercalcemia. It's thought possibly that you won't get hypercalcemia if you have normal functioning kidneys. And if you have hypercalcemia with a thiazide, there may be coexisting hyperparathyroidism. That's not always true, but it could be. So once you stop the thiazide, you may have to reevaluate for hyperparathyroidism. Milk alkali syndrome, these are people possibly with gastric ulcers, and the classic setting is that they're treated with absorbable antacids, which has a lot of bicarbonate, Alka-Seltzer or something like that, large quantities of milk and cream. So they're getting a lot of calcium and bicarb, and that gives you this hypercalcemia with the metabolic alkalosis and renal failure. Again, the treatment is to stop all of that stuff if possible. Use alternative therapy for the gastric ulcer. I think before we had the PPIs and we were doing, you know, selective vagotomies and enterectomies, that used to be a treatment. Not so much nowadays. Now that we know what causes ulcers, we have better treatment. Hypervitaminosis A, it's not something we measure often, but when all else fails, you might have to get a level. You have to take huge amounts of vitamin A. Other retinoids, so Retin-A and Accutane for acne may be contributing to this. It directly stimulates osteoclast-mediated bone resorption. So it's working like parathyroid, like RANK ligand on the osteoclast, but we don't know exactly how it's doing that. And again, you'll have suppressed parathyroid and vitamin D. Because it's stimulating the osteoclast and calcium is high, so this is physiologic suppression of those. Well, A, D, E, K are the fat-soluble vitamins, so if you have too much A, if you have too much D, it's going to hang out in the fat for a long time, possibly many, many months, and after you stop it, you can still have hypercalcemia, so you have to keep the patient well hydrated and make sure that they're off the medications. Interestingly, glucocorticoids as well as general measures such as hydration and decrease in calcium intake. Glucocorticoids can help in this syndrome. So then we look at granulomatosis. And there are a variety of things we see out there, TB, leprosy, histo. In Nashville, where I did some training, we had a lot of histo. You get an x-ray and see all these little spots. And it wasn't necessarily pathologic in that situation. Crypto, CMV, HIV. And what happens is that the 1-hydroxylase is activated in granulomatous disease, and that'll stimulate your 1-hydroxylation of 25-hydroxy vitamin D. You get the active form, and that causes increased calcium reabsorption in the gut, in the kidney, and hypercalcemia. So treatment is treatment of the underlying disease. Sarcoidosis, other things that cause granuloma, silicone, eosinophilic, Wegener's granulomatosis. So if you have a high 125-dihydroxy vitamin D and a low PTH and a low PTHRP, and your bone markers are low, and you're thinking, you know, this is vitamin D mediated, and you have a high 125-dihydroxy D, sarcoidosis is going to be 50%. So you have to have a high index of suspicion in that patient, you know, especially if they're black. But even in Caucasian, you might get an ACE level, a chest x-ray, and look for bilateral hyaluronopathy, stage 1. And here you can see your non-caseating granuloma. So that'll diagnose that patient, and then you treat them accordingly. Miscellaneous recovery phase of rhabdomyolysis, aluminum, various other syndromes. Renal failure is another complicated issue, whether it's you know, tertiary hyperparathyroidism for long-standing renal failure where you get hyperplasia, and that's a subject for another discussion. Immobilization. So we had a patient in Pinecrest who likely had this from immobilization. The skeleton has mechanoreceptors, and it kind of senses the physical load and will adjust the calcium intake accordingly. So the opposite will happen. Bone mass is lost with physical unloading of the bone, such as prolonged bed rest. And they've been doing some experiments with weightlessness in space for the astronauts, and they get significant osteoporosis because they don't have loading of bone. Mechanism of bone loss is uncoupling of the bone turnover. So you have decreased bone formation, increased bone resorption, and thereby you get release of calcium and phosphorus from the bone matrix. You get hypercalcemia and you get hypercalciuria as this process happens. The treatment is to load up the bone, you know, physical therapy. And if you need, if someone's bedridden, then you have to get a bed that'll turn them and load the bone, do passive movement of the extremities to try and load up the bone and reabsorb the calcium. Other endocrine causes, hyperthyroidism, adrenal insufficiency, VO, VIP, secreting tumors, which we work up for a lot and don't see very commonly. So it's been documented in Graves, toxic multinodular goiter, toxic adenoma, subacute thyroiditis, and 50% of the patients with thyrotoxicosis present with hypercalcemia. So when you see it, when someone comes in thyrotoxic and you see the hypercalcemia, you know, there can be coexisting hyperparathyroidism because it's so common, but it may resolve the treatment of the hyperthyroidism. Pheochromocytoma, much less common than hyperthyroidism, of course. In many cases, it's concomitant primary hyperparathyroidism in people with known MEN2. Elevated catecholamines themselves can increase bone turnover. So hyperthyroidism makes you more sensitive to catecholamines. So this may be the mechanism in hyperthyroidism as well. And again, pheos, like some of these neuroendocrine tumors, can secrete PTH-related protein as well. So you could measure for that and see where you stand. Primary adrenal insufficiency, there may be other things going on causing hypercalcemia. Often you're volume depleted, which can lead to hypercalcemia and can be seen in secondary adrenal insufficiency. Again, the parathyroid and vitamin D should be suppressed, and this will respond well to IV fluids. And of course, you're going to treat with corticosteroids if the patient has adrenal insufficiency, and that should resolve the problem. So then we get down to the evaluation process. So someone comes in and they have hypercalcemia, and whether it's outpatient or inpatient, you've got to figure out what's going on with them. So again, the history and the family history is the most important thing. Look at their medications, especially the vitamin history. And as you guys know, in the USA, we have the most expensive urine in the world. People will balk at paying $100 a month for a diabetic medication, but they'll go to, you know, the vitamin shop, GNC, order online, whatever it might be, and they'll be paying $300-$400 a month for vitamins that they may not need. So often people won't give you that history. They typically don't give you a history of vitamins, birth control, various other things, and you have to elicit that from them. So the very first thing you do is parathyroid. And when I was doing my fellowship, we had C-terminal, N-terminal, we had mid-peptide. You ordered a different one depending on the state of renal function. But now basically we do a dual antibody sandwich method, monoclonal assay, and we get a PTH intact. And this will stratify you into high PTH or low PTH, and then you go from there. You will want to get an ionized calcium because various things can cause hypercalcemia, but not elevated ionized calcium. Again, you know, the pH can affect the ionized calcium. I had a case of Waldenstrom's where the total calcium was in the 12s, but the ionized calcium was normal, and the treatment was not treatment of hypercalcemia, but treatment of the underlying disease. So the ionized is important. Then you can look for paraproteinemias. The fed rate's very nonspecific, but if it's elevated, you can start looking at things like malignancy, you know, infection, granulomas disease, so on. But it's important to get your vitamin D metabolites. And again, the 25 hydroxy vitamin D, this is usually dietary, whether it's D3 or D2. And then the 125 dihydroxy vitamin D, because then you're looking at granulomas disease, lymphoma, etc. And again, parathyroid, if it's high, should stimulate 125D as well. And if they're both high, that is consistent with hypoparathyroidism. Your electrolytes, of course, your BUN and creatinine, looking at your hydration state, alkaline phosphatase, the phosphorus. The phosphorus doesn't always have to be low in primary hyperparathyroidism, but when it is low, you know, down in the twos, it makes you feel more comfortable sending the patient to surgery when the diagnosis is somewhat equivocal. Other things you want to look at, you know, ostase and bone-specific alkaline phosphatase, the urine and serum telopeptides, the collagen type 1 breakdown products, they should be high in hyperparathyroidism. The ACE level, looking at sarcoid, looking at calcitonin for multiple endocrine neoplasia, type 2 or familial hyperparathyroidism in this situation, and then looking at genetics. And there's a huge spectrum of genetics that you can look at, looking at MEN, of course, 1 and 2, looking at the calcium sensing receptor, and there's two pages of different genetics that I didn't want to put up here because that gets a little more involved. Imaging, of course, you know, the chest x-ray that we looked at in terms of sarcoidosis, you might see lymphoma, you might see a huge goiter, a neck ultrasound. So what's the sensitivity of ultrasound for parathyroid? It depends on how good the probe is, how good the technician is, how good the reader is, and the parathyroids are usually posterior. So if you see a nodule that you think is parathyroid and they look kind of like lymph nodes, they're kind of dark and well circumscribed usually and fairly small, but if they're anterior, they're probably not parathyroid. If they're posterior, they may well be. And the sensitivity can range from about 65 to 85%. The sestamibi scan, you don't have to do it as an outpatient if you know what the diagnosis is. Your surgeon's probably going to do one intraoperatively for localization. But they're about 89% sensitive when you have clear-cut hyperparathyroidism. But if the parathyroid level is under 100, they may only be 80% sensitive. So if I have a parathyroid that's in the 80s and a calcium of 10.5, the scan's probably going to be negative. So I probably wouldn't bother. Renal ultrasound to look for kidney stones. That's one of the surgical criteria that we'll go over. And the bone density, looking for osteoporosis, T-score of minus 2.5, defining osteoporosis. If you have that, that might be an indication for surgery too. So therapy of hypercalcemia. Now we've made a diagnosis, or we might not have. We're waiting for the labs to come back. We're waiting for imaging studies. What are you going to do when the patient comes in all goofy and they're holding their belly, they haven't had a bowel movement in 2 weeks, and the calcium's 13 and they're lethargic? You want to increase the urinary excretion of calcium, so you're going to hydrate. You may chase that with some Lasix as well. Decrease the intestinal absorption. So if vitamin D levels are too high, you want to shut that off. And decrease bone resorption, and we have ways of doing that. So almost all the patients are dehydrated. It's like when you have glucosuria, you have hypercalciuria, and you want to give them fluids, and you may chase with diuretics. Calcitonin, again, we don't know its physiologic role, but for about 10 days, that'll lower your calcium. You can give that by injection or intranasal. IV bisphosphonates, I'm sure you guys have used that, and I have some blow-ups of these. We'll go over in detail. Gallium, mithromycin, oplicomycin, steroids, dialysis, and typically we don't use phosphate because it binds to calcium and deposits in tissues, but if all else fails, it could be done. So hydration, normal saline, 3 to 6 liters of IV daily for 1 to 3 days, 125 to 250 an hour. You have to be careful because if you have an elderly patient, they may have CHF, and that could precipitate volume overload, and that's when you definitely would want to use a loop diuretic in conjunction with hydration. It'll kick in fairly quickly. Rehydration, enhanced filtration and excretion of calcium, the renal function will improve. And that's the very first thing we do. Dialysis we'd reserve if the GFR is very low, and so you're not going to achieve an adequate diuresis with fluids. Of course, it's invasive. You can further hypotension when you go in and pull off fluids, so you may want to hydrate as well as doing dialysis if necessary. So calcitonin, and this is what I'll use most commonly along with fluids, first line, if the patient's symptomatic, usually starting with 4 units. Per kilo, giving it IM or sub-Q every 12 hours. It'll kick in very quickly and minimal toxicity. But some people might have a flushing syndrome and nausea, so you use a test dose, and you can go in with the electronic orders, and you'll see that you can either order calcitonin or a test dose with the dose, and you just put that in the pharmacy. It'll get it up for you fairly quickly. You get tachyphylaxis, so after 10 days it stops working. So if someone's in hospital for a long time and they're doing well on this, they will do not so well after about 10 days and you may have to go to additional therapy. So what is Cinacalcet? The brand name in this country is Sensipar, and it's used primarily in patients with hyperparathyroidism refusing surgery. It was initially approved for parathyroid carcinoma. And again, we see that very rarely. It's now approved for primary hyperparathyroidism. While it's exceedingly expensive, usually it's around $700 patient cost per month. But if there are contraindications to surgery or you need to temporize, you can use Sensipar. Usual dose is 30, 60, or 90 milligrams daily. I start at 30 and see how they do. Side effects of nausea and vomiting. So the hypercalcemia can cause these same symptoms, and the medication can. Ask the patient to try and, you know, stay the course and hold out. Unfortunately, it doesn't protect bones from parathyroid-induced bone loss. And why is that? Well, when the parathyroid is somewhat elevated, even at low levels, and you may have brought it down, in one study, 55% of them achieved normal carcinia with Cinacalcet. The parathyroid level is still somewhat elevated, so the osteoclast is continuously removing bone. As opposed to intermittent parathyroid secretion like we do, say, with Forteo for osteoporosis, where you actually will stimulate bone growth because the osteoblasts will come in behind the osteoclast. So you do get continuation of osteoporosis when you use this, so you may have to use this in conjunction with an anti-resorptive. So here's the data on Cinacalcet, patients with intractable primary hyperparathyroidism. This is weeks, and you can see it's very rapid. And then, as long as you're on the drug and maintenance, you'll maintain the calcium level somewhere in this range, just above 10 on average. And the parathyroid level will bump up and down, and eventually, this is at week 40, two-thirds of the year, and then the parathyroid level will come down for maintenance. So it does work quite well. So then we'll talk about bisphosphonates. So, alendronate was approved for use in osteoporosis. These go in and prevent bone resorption. You need the creatinine clearance to be above 35 for safe use. You want to hydrate well. Tell the patients to stay well hydrated before and during. They're used to prevent the bone loss associated with hyperparathyroidism or other causes of osteoporosis. Can be used in conjunction with Cinacalcet, as I mentioned. and these are some of the ones available, and it should suppress the markers of bone turnover. So a couple of weeks after treatment with one of the bisphosphonates, you can measure the OSPACE or BSAP or the urine markers, the UMPF, and they should be suppressed. They also have some GI symptoms, common theme over here, potentially limiting. So if we're looking at pimidronate, 30, 60, or 90 milligrams IV over 2 hours, I usually do it in saline for the hydration, onset of action 1 to 3 days. They're very, very potent, less expensive than zoledric acid. Zoledric acid, however, is 100 times more potent than pimidronate. So if someone's really got hypercalcemia, you may want to use this one. So the risks of these agents are renal failure, transient fever, aches, chills. Sometimes patients won't get treated. A couple days later, they call us and they say, I've got the flu. That drug caused the flu. It's not the flu, but symptomatic treatment, usually with Tylenol and hydration, and you'll get them through this. It usually lasts up to 5 to 7 days. Osteonecrosis of the jaw. Usually that's seen only when people are treated repetitively with this, such as people with cancer getting it monthly. But you can see it otherwise in outpatient settings as well. And then possibly atrial fibrillation precipitated by fluxes in calcium, we're not quite sure. As I mentioned, Zometa, it's the most potent one, 100 times stronger than the Iridia, and it's got the same potential side effects, but potentially more benefit. Glucocorticoids you can use. Obviously, when you have adrenal insufficiency with hypercalcemia, you're going to do this. Specific conditions such as lymphoma or sarcoidosis, where steroids may be the primary treatment, it's going to be beneficial, and then also beneficial in vitamin D and in vitamin A intoxication. And the side effects would be Cushing syndrome, hypertension, hyperglycemia, and long-term use, changes in skin, cataracts, and so on. Mithromycin, I've only used once, 25 micrograms per kilogram. It's a chemotherapeutic agent, but it works very well for hypercalcemia. You want to hydrate very well. It works like a bisphosphonate in terms of its action and its duration, but it has all these potential side effects. So I really don't use this anymore unless there's nothing available in the pharmacy. So then we get on to denosumab. You guys have heard of Prolia. It's like a flu shot. You get a shot every 6 months in the doctor's office. And it's not FDA-approved for hypercalcemia, but is approved for osteoporosis. And as you can see, when you have the serum calcium, it will come down very nicely. So what does this do? This interferes with RANK ligand, and so you don't get RANK ligand binding to the receptor on the osteoclast, so you're reducing osteoclast activity, and the calcium comes down very nicely. Again, not yet FDA-approved. Other things, anti-PTHRP antibody, again, not FDA approved, but they had a patient with persistent hypercalcemia, and they came up with this treatment, and you can look at the total calcium and the ionized calcium, and you can see a reduction with this. So once we learn more and more about the metabolism of calcium, what causes hypercalcemia, we can look at more therapeutic targets in terms of treatment. Primary hyperparathyroidism. Maybe why you all came here. What do we do with these patients? Well, we operate. My partners who started here 36 years ago were taught, well, you watch them, you look at all the criteria, and when they hit the criteria, then you operate. I was taught once you diagnose it, you operate, because the patient's only going to be a lot sicker, more comorbidities in 5 to 10 years, more osteoporosis, kidney stones, and so on, so operate. But these are the criteria in 2002. A few years ago, they took out the hypercalciuria criteria, but it's being put back in the recent publication consensus. Calcium 1 point above normal, so 9.5 is normal. With a range of 8.5 to 10.5, that would mean if you're 11.5 or above, that's a surgical criteria. Life-threatening hypercalcemia, the patient's in a stupor or coma, recurrent kidney stones, hypercalciuria, and you do the 24-hour urine collections, and you can calculate your calcium to creatinine ratio as well if you're looking for FHH, and reduction in creatinine clearance. So osteoporosis as defined by the World Health Organization with a T-score of minus 2.5, and then younger age. So again, you're going to operate on people earlier if they have these. So there's a couple of ways you can do it. The traditional surgery way, you go in, and when I was in Michigan, Dr. Norman Thompson did these operations, and he would say, well, how do you know if it's parathyroid or fat? Because they kind of look the same. And he'd rub his finger over, it's fat, 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 and he'd say, ah, oh, parathyroid. And the parathyroid is kind of silky, and he described it as silky and sensuous to the touch, whereas fat is not so much. And so we didn't have system maybe scans. We didn't have very good ultrasounds back then. So there was a 97% success rate in the hands of a good surgeon like Dr. Thompson. And I see Dr. Woodruff skipped out to operate. But once you have the diagnosis, surgery is very successful. If localization is unclear, if you suspect hyperplasia, you need to do a 3.5 gland resection for this. If they've had previous surgery that was failed, you need to go in and open up the neck and take a good look. These things can hide in all kinds of places. The minimally invasive procedure can be done as an outpatient. Patient comes in, PTH assay intraoperatively with a sestamibi. Usually it's one or two glands, usually one. You pop them out, you put them on high-dose calcium, 125 dihydroxy, as well as the calcium, and they can go home the same day, potentially. It's best with intraoperative sestamibi and the rapid parathyroid assay. Parathyroid rates, however, are declining for whatever reason, and I'm not going to speculate as to why that may be. I think we see a ton of hyperparathyroidism, and I think ultimately these people should be operated on. It may be because we have other treatment modalities, and that makes us feel safe about it, but the patient will go on to get comorbidity, so we should operate. So here's a sestamibi scan. What you do basically is like a thyroid scan, and the thyroids will light up, the salivary glands will light up, and then you wait a while and you get a subtraction, and you can see that part of the thyroid here is kind of washed out, and then you see the parathyroid adenoma in this left lower pole position. Here's another one in the right lower pole. That's pretty hot. This is the ultrasound finding. Again, it looks a little bit like a lymph node, fairly well circumscribed, hypoechoic, meaning darker on ultrasound. And again, this will be posterior. So here's the trachea, and this is a right posterior parathyroid adenoma. However, they can be anywhere on the milk line. So going down into the chest, here we see one in the chest. Here we see a parathyroid in the chest on imaging. So when you do your parathyroid scans, especially if you're unclear of the diagnosis, make sure that they do image the chest so you can look for these ectopics. So what do you do if you're not going to operate? You monitor the bone density for bone loss, even within the osteopenic range. And typically I'll want to look at the wrist, the forearm, because that's cortical bone. It's the only thing that you measure on a bone density with cortical bone, and that's parathyroid action. It doesn't really work that much on the other sites. So it's important to order that. I'll do the hip and I'll do the spine, and I'll also get an LFA or an LVA. So these are a lateral spine shot where you look for a pathologic fracture that may be occult. So you can look at wedge deformities, and if someone has a pathologic fracture, it puts them in a much higher risk for subsequent fractures, so you'll treat them more aggressively, either for osteoporosis and or hyperparathyroidism. Look for renal calculi, so do an ultrasound, if clinically warranted, otherwise once every couple of years. Treat associated deficiency of vitamin D to a minimum level of 20. So that's kind of counterintuitive. The calcium's high. Why should I give vitamin D? Well, if you don't, it may worsen the hyperparathyroidism. The range 10 years ago for vitamin D, this is 25 vitamin D, was 8 to 20 until we found that levels below 35 were associated with different pathologic states. And so really we try and get everyone above 35. But in people with primary hyperparathyroidism, get them above 20. So if you keep following them, the risk of complication ranges, depending on comorbidities, 23 to 62%. So keep that in mind if you're watching them without surgery. I saw a lady yesterday who absolutely refuses surgery. And she's got T-scores of minus 3.5. She's going to fracture, but she refuses surgery, and we're watching her. So that's all I have to say about hypercalcemia this morning. It's very, very common. In the outpatient setting, it's usually primary hyperparathyroidism. And the evaluation process is fairly straightforward, but there are impostors like FHH, malignancies, granulomatous disease, and then the genetic disorders like the MEN syndromes that you have to look for, and sometimes it gets a little more complicated. The first thing we do in the hospital is hydration, probably calcitonin. If they have good renal function, we use bisphosphonates, and then we go from there. So, thanks, everyone, for coming. And if you have any questions, yes, sir. So, great question. So this isn't about hypercalcemia per se, but this may be about how to prevent hypercalcemia in target organs, such as the brain, heart, conduction system, kidneys, etc. And it's pretty controversial still, I think, because there was a study that came out saying that if you took too much exogenous calcium in terms of pills, it increased your risk for stroke and then potentially for heart attack. And I have a friend who actually was taking 3 grams of calcium because it was recommended, so calcium carbonate. That's only 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium, not above any guidelines by any means. For osteoporosis, we said 1,500 milligrams. For osteopenia, 1,200 just a few years ago. But he developed calcium buildup in his conduction system, and he's got all kinds of problems. So then we said, well, try get it through normal dietary means such as, you know, dairy, yogurt, whatever it might be, and fortified orange juice, getting your calcium and vitamin D. And more recently, there's a study that's kind of refuted that, so that you should be taking the extra calcium. So right now, we're trying to figure out how much calcium we should take in terms of elemental calcium. And I can't give you an exact answer as to what you should do, but I had a patient this week who has osteoporosis and was told, oh, you got to stop taking all of your calcium. And we know that patient's going to fracture. And you know, you have to take some calcium. So just like when you have primary hyperparathyroidism and you're told to not have any vitamin D or calcium in your diet, you still need to get the vitamin D above 20. And calcium intake doesn't really make a huge difference in primary hyperparathyroidism. It doesn't affect the levels very much. So if someone's got severe osteoporosis, I'm still trying to get them to take about 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium. What form should it be? That's also controversial. Calcium carbonate. Perhaps the PPIs prevent the absorption of elemental calcium and calcium carbonate, and they should be on calcium citrate. That's also somewhat controversial. Again, carbonate's 40% elemental calcium and citrate's 21% elemental calcium. So you have to do that calculation when you're trying to determine it. But, almost all of my patients need calcium intake, especially with osteoporosis. Maybe next time I'm up here, I'll have a better answer. So I can't give you an exact number. So, but you're typically giving people calcium, even with mild hyperparathyroidism. Makes sense. You got to give people the building blocks, otherwise the building comes tumbling down. Okay, any other questions out there? All right, thanks everyone.